Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th Canto, Chapter 9, The Dynasty of Amshuman, text numbers 4 through 5. So Kalindi's putting the verse on the board today, doing her devotional service. She chants one round a day, she told me. You told me every day, Kalindi. You were cheating me, huh? Oh, the desires here. Okay. You're finished? All right.
Kim chaham na bhuvang yase naramayam rajanchagam mrijami tat agam kvaham rajam tatra vichinchyatam.
Okay, text forward. Mother Ganges replied, "When I fall from the sky to the surface of the planet Earth, the water will certainly be very forceful. Who will sustain that force? If I am not sustained, I shall pierce the surface of the Earth and go down to Rasatala, the Patala area of the universe. O King, I do not wish to go down to the planet Earth. For there the people in general will bathe in my water to cleanse themselves of the reactions of their sinful deeds. When all these sinful reactions accumulate in me, how shall I become free from them? You must consider this very carefully." Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead says, Sarvadharman Pratyajya Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja Aham tvam sarva papebhyo mukshayishyami ma shucha. Abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. I shall deliver you from all sinful reaction. Do not fear. The Supreme Personality of Godhead can accept the reactions of anyone's sinful deeds and neutralize them because he is pavitra, pure like the sun, which is never contaminated by any worldly infection. Teji asam doshaya vahne sava bhujoyata. One who is very powerful is not affected by any sinful activity. But here we see that Mother Ganges fears being burdened with the sins of the people in general who would bathe in her waters. This indicates that no one but the Supreme Personality of Godhead is able to neutralize the reactions of sinful deeds, whether one's own or those of others. Sometimes the spiritual master, after accepting a disciple, must take charge of that disciple's past sinful activities, and, being overloaded, must sometimes suffer, if not fully, then partially, for the sinful acts of the disciple. Every disciple, therefore, must be very careful not to commit sinful activities after initiation. The poor spiritual master is kind and merciful enough to accept a disciple and partially suffer for that disciple's sinful activities. But Krishna, being merciful to his servant, neutralizes the reactions of sinful deeds for the servant who engages in preaching his glories. Even Mother Ganges feared the sinful reactions of the people in general and was anxious about how she would counteract the burden of these sins. Om Ajnanatimirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Grata Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Every intelligent person should be concerned about sinful reactions. This material world is a place where you accumulate sinful activity, sinful reactions, even against your will. You know how Arjuna asks Krishna the question in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. How is it that people perform sinful activity even against their own will? They may want to do good, but they get caught by something. In fundamentalist Christian lingo, people often say of that type, the devil made me do it. And in Krishna consciousness, we have our more scientific understanding. We'll say, I was caught by the illusory energy. So, in either case, whether you have a very simplistic understanding of how the world operates, and you just say the devil made me do it, or if you have a sophisticated Vedic outlook and you understand the Lord and his energies and how these energies interact, in either case, the fact is, you have to be careful in this world. An intelligent person is a careful person who engineers and manages his or her life so that sinful activity will not overtake you, consciously or unconsciously. This world is a dangerous place for that reason. I was thinking these past 2 days of having to go through the whole process of theft and dealing with the police and recover your stolen goods. And just like a thief steals into your house suddenly. Now in Bayswater it's happening during the day, even when you're home. Similarly, sinful activity can attack you. That's the nature of this world. Don't simply worry about the thieves. Worry about the six highway robbers mentioned in the Shastra. Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Mada, Matsarya, Moha. Lust, anger, greed, madness, envy, and illusion. You have to be on the lookout for these plunderers, which destroy your spiritual life. An intelligent person arranges his or her life to be protected against these things. Just like when I was at the police department, they had a wall full of brochures. So I had to wait. They were interviewing everybody. They were showing Seva Kunj videos of the crims and, getting all the statements ready, for their court case on Friday. They weren't wasting any time. They were quite happy. We finally got these guys cold. So, and I had to make a statement too. And meanwhile, I was waiting, I was reading the brochures. There was one brochure prepared, by the local cop shop, informing citizens what to do to make your house safe. I had a whole list of items. Like, I could see immediately that Akendra's house fell in the unsafe area because they say, fell in the unsafe category because they said, don't have big shrubs and bushes in front of your house so people can't see it from the can't see the entrance from the street. So, and do this to your windows, do that to your door, have this kind of lock on the door. So they were, doing their public service of informing the homeowners, this is what you have to do to make your house safe. And naturally people appreciate that. Yes, it's nice the police have our interest at heart. What about when we try to inform people through the Shastra that there is such a thing as sinful activity and sinful reactions? There's no appreciation. What is this outmoded stuff that there's sin? People don't even like to use that word anymore. It's considered psychologically debilitating. It's considered repressive. It's considered old-fashioned. fairy tales, sinners in the hand of an angry God. All that kind of paranoia. People think we've progressed far beyond that. Now it's just you, and you have to decide how to live your life. And everything is a learning experience that you encounter. So just learn whatever lesson you think you're supposed to learn. And, of course, the universe is evolving towards perfection. And you're in the universe, so gradually you'll also evolve towards perfection. So just live life as you see best. You be the judge. Don't burden your shoulders with any dogma, religious authoritarianism, which makes your spiritual life, your spiritual development, very claustrophobic, very boxed up. No, you yourself, let your creative juices flow and devise your own system of morality, your own system of decision-making and what is right, what is wrong. That is the noble path. That is the best thing. You decide. You manufacture dharma. It should come from you, according to you. And everybody will nod their head. Ooh, yes, this is very sublime. Yes, you are definitely an advanced person. Because you make up your own dharma, you make up your own morality, and you change it according to circumstances, according to how you feel. I'm sure you all have, know many persons like that. Maybe they took the trouble to get married, and then later they felt, well, it's not working, and so I have to, relationship's not working, so I have to kind of do something else, and I've made that decision, and my partner just has to understand that, you know, I mean, you know, this is how life works, and people will nod their heads, yes, you've just got to do what you've got to do to be happy. That's the ultimate bottom line. As long as you're happy, do anything. But are you happy at the moment? And that's all that parents can tell their children these days. Whatever it is, just be happy. That's the only advice parents can give to their children. What else can they say to their kids? Besides, watch out for your economic future, and whatever you do, just be happy. As long as it makes you happy. Bring a, you know, if you're a girl, bring a guy home, let him stay in your room with you, you know. Bring a girl home, let her stay with you. Yeah. Bring a tomato home, stay with that, whatever. Just if you're happy, you know, that's the main thing, you know. That's all parents can tell their children these days. This idea, you see, we really haven't fully understood how much this New Age notion has permeated the general population. Now, certainly the general population you wouldn't classify as New Age, but the New Age ideas have filtered into general society so that everybody's touched by it. You're not going to find all of Perth at the mind, body, and spirit festivals. Do we still do those? You won't find the whole city there, but you'll find that somehow or other everyone's been touched by the notions that there's no one system, there's no one truth. You are your own truth. Make your own truth. And you decide what makes you happy. Don't become burdened by religious scriptures, religious priests, official religious persons. That is not spiritual. I tell you, you have to discriminate between religion and spirituality. This is even creeping into India now, amongst the sophisticated cosmopolitan urbanites. They're also talking like this. Devotees in Mumbai were telling me. People are, you know, sophisticated people are starting to say, I'm not into religion, I'm into spirituality. However it flows. So we see that. Ultimately, all these notions mean rejection of dharma and the source of all dharma. Human beings don't want to acknowledge any superior control. So it's a very creative and apparently satisfying mental adjustment to rid yourself of the notion of sin and sinful reaction. Now, mentally you may rid yourself of that, but in reality, the reactions will be there. What is the proof that there are sinful reactions? The proof is that there is suffering. The proof is that there is disease. There is death. There is loss. There are inflictions of misery. That is the result of sinful activity. So as long as you see those miserable things in the world, you should know that there are sinful reactions. Otherwise, why does one person take birth in very low circumstances? And somebody else take birth in very comfortable circumstances? Why is that? Because of varying levels of sinful activity in the previous life. Or even someone can take birth in wealthy circumstances and then die at an early age. Someone can take birth in poor circumstances and become fabulously wealthy. It's all about how the pious and impious reactions enter into your life. An intelligent person perceives the whole world as a web of reactions. You just don't walk around and see the sky and the roads and the houses and the cars. You see everywhere reactions to past activities. That is the real vision of this world. Some people are getting pious reactions. Just like Australia. It's known as the lucky country. Well, if you were here, when did the first inhabitants from Europe come here? 200 years ago. If you had been here 200 years ago, you wouldn't have called it the lucky country because you would have been in prison. So those people were experiencing the reactions to their simple activities. Not so much by that the court was giving them simple reactions. No, the courts may be right, the courts may be wrong, but the laws of karma are not wrong. So according to things they did in their previous life, they had to undergo legal entanglements and suffer in this life. So 200 years ago, if you were one of the persons first sent to Australia, you wouldn't call it the lucky country. You'd be suffering very much. But now, things have changed, so this is the lucky country at this moment. You can see that people are not doing any dharma. They're not doing any religion, but still things, for the moment, are relatively nice. But that can all change in a moment. Same with the USA. Prabhupada said that the prosperity and dominance of the USA is due to pious activities performed in the past. But certainly there are no pious activities being performed now. So that means, at some point, the tide turns. Because the people do not know how to perform more pious activities to sustain their prosperity. No one knows that. Every country today is simply riding on the pious activities, or every prosperous country is riding on the pious activities performed by their people in the past lives. But no one is generating new pious activities now. Therefore, everything must run down. The only hope is the Sankirtan Yajna, which is beyond material piety and impiety. So if they don't allow the Sankirtan Yajna, then there certainly is no hope. An intelligent person is concerned. What will the reactions to my actions be? Arjuna demonstrated this in Bhagavad Gita. He didn't want to fight. And he was saying that sin will overcome us if we slay these aggressors, Atatayana. They're aggressors, Atatayana. According to ordinary Vedic injunctions, aggressors should be met with aggression. But Arjuna was saying, they're not the ordinary category of Atatayana, aggressors. They are friends, relatives, teachers. So how can I fight them? Let's be saintly. That's what he's telling Krishna. Let's be saintly. Let's do the saintly thing. No good will come out of this. Let them have it all. We'll turn the other cheek. Let's be saintly. Krishna wasn't interested in that type of saintliness for Arjuna. For for Arjuna, the proper type of saintliness was that he fight. You see, within the world of bhakti, there is variety. So Krishna was saying, for you, for your individuality, no, this type of saintliness that you're suggesting is not for you. But for you, the saintly behavior is to fight against aggressors, even if they're your friends and relatives. Why would Arjuna seek to instruct Bhagavan Sri Krishna in morality? Krishna is the source of all dharma. So why does Krishna need dharma lessons from Arjuna? Arjuna is overwhelmed by illusion, by the arrangement of Krishna, so that we can see what it's like to be an illusion. Overwhelmed by illusion, Arjuna is forgetting that Krishna is the source of all dharma, and he's lecturing Krishna on dharma, religiosity, social knowledge, you know, society will break down if we fight. Sukhina Sama Madhava. If we kill, what will we get out of it? If we kill these people, how can we be happy? Sukhina Sama Madhava. Oh Madhava, you're the companion of the goddess of fortune. Tell me, where will the good fortune be if we fight? Arjuna's concerns were misapplied, as everyone knows. Misconceived, misconstrued. Yet still, he is noteworthy in this presentation for being concerned with sinful activity. So that point is raised in the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita. An intelligent person is concerned with the reactions to actions. Now that kind of intelligence is not given today. You'll go to no school or university where they'll equip you with knowledge of sinful reactions and how to avoid sinful reactions. Since that knowledge is not there, how can people say they are equipped for a future? How can your parents dare to think that you're properly equipped for living in this world when you have no knowledge of what is sinful activity, what are sinful reactions? Arjuna had that fear. Oh, this will be sinful. We shouldn't do this. So Krishna explained the whole science of bhakti yoga. How you can act in this world without incurring reaction. A thoughtful person wants to know this. What is the science of non-reactive work? I have to be active. So how can I be active in a way that brings no reaction? That is the mystery of Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, at the end of Bhagavad Gita, Sanjaya concludes, Yatra Yogeshvara Krishna Yatra Partha Dhanurdhara. Wherever there is Krishna, the master of all mystic power, wherever there is Arjuna, the best of archers, bowmen, there will always be victory, power, and morality. Even amidst this war, which seems so tragic, a fratricidal war, still Arjuna could fight and be untouched by sinful reaction. Even when Krishna told him to kill Karna, when Karna was off the chariot, fixing his broken chariot wheel, Krishna told Arjuna, kill him. He didn't give any mercy to Abhimanyu. There'll be no mercy for him. Out with him. Take him out. Still, no sinful reaction for Arjuna. And you know how Yudhisthira was instructed by Krishna to tell a lie. Ashwatthama is dead, so that Ashwatthama's father would be brokenhearted and wouldn't be able to fight properly. And Yudhisthira hesitated. Ooh, I'm Dharmaraj. I'm the king of religion. How can I tell a lie? I'm famous for never having lied. But Krishna said, do it. Just say Ashwatthama is dead. You know, Krishna's, Prabhupada said, Krishna did everything so the Pandavas would win. Krishna just did everything legal, and he cut corners too, as the Supreme Personality got it, so that the Pandavas would win. So the Lord himself told Yudhisthira, just say Ashwatthama is dead. So Ashwatthama's father, who is Ashwatthama's father? Dronacharya. So Dronacharya would be disheartened and would therefore give up fighting with great strength. And you know, Yudhisthira hesitated. Me, Dharmaraj, tell a lie? So because he got shaky, Krishna said, all right, here's how you can still do it and be truthful. There's an elephant named Ashwatthama who's just died. So you say Ashwatthama is dead, and it'll still be true. But Dronacharya will think you're referring to his son. This is Krishna. He does, for his devotee, he's willing to turn everything upside down. Arjuna was wrong to try and apply the moral codes to Krishna. But moral codes are meant to prepare you for surrendering to Krishna. So why should you use moral codes as a reason not to follow Krishna's order to fight, when actually moral codes are meant to bring you close to Krishna so that you'll accept his order? So that's why Krishna had to preach, teach the whole Bhagavad Gita, to demonstrate that you can be active and not get reactions. This had to be, this point had to be established very clearly. Now you see in today's verse, Mother Ganges, she's worried about, they're going to load me up with sins. Ganga Devi is feeling that way. Okay, Maharaj Bhagirata, I'm satisfied by your austerities, and I'm prepared to give you benedictions as you desire. So, Maharaj Bhagirata said, please, come down to the earth planet, because Lord Kapildeva said the only way my ancestors will be brought back to life is if the Ganges water comes. So Mother Ganges replied, but you have to take into account certain things by your request. When I fall from the heavens to the earth planet, the force of my water is going to be so great, coming from so high in the cosmos. Can the earth handle all this water pressure? Otherwise, if nothing catches me, I'll pierce through the earth and go down to the lower planets. In other words, Mother Ganges doesn't want to flow down in the lower planetary system where the sinful living entities are. And she said, furthermore, not only that, but let's look at what will happen to me on earth. People will flock to bathe in me in order to cleanse themselves of sinful reactions. All these reactions are going to accumulate in me. How am I going to be free from all this? You've got to think about this. Once again, we see real intelligence at work. Ganga Devi is thinking, I don't have sins, but people will bathe in me and leave their sins, their sinful reactions in me. What am I going to do? I don't want all this. So in the purport, Prabhupada explains how the fact that Mother Ganges feared being burdened with the sins of the people who would bathe in her waters shows that actually no one but the Supreme Personality of Godhead is able to neutralize sinful deeds, whether your own or someone else's. Even Mother Ganges is concerned, how can I handle this? Therefore, when Krishna says at the end of the Gita, Sarvadhamam Pratyaja, surrender to me, I'll protect you from all sinful reactions, that ability is Krishna's alone. Now, what about the devotee of the Lord? Well, Prabhupada explains that the spiritual master, upon accepting a disciple, must take charge of the disciple's past sinful activities. And sometimes it gets to be a bit much. And so the spiritual master may have to suffer a bit, some kind of calamity or tribulation. But Krishna is always there to take care of his dedicated servant who's risking everything for preaching the glories of the Lord. Two things are going on at once. That sinful reactions are being passed from disciple to the spiritual master, and Krishna is helping to make sure this, you know, this, that the load of sinful activities doesn't become too much. Because it's actually Krishna who neutralizes the sinful activities. So again, at the end of the purport, Prabhupada makes the emphatic point, even Mother Ganges feared the sinful reactions of the people in general and was anxious about how she would counteract the burden of those sins. Now what about our own anxiety? Are we fearful that, oh, I'm living in this contaminated world, I don't want to be compromised? As I told you before, Srila Prabhupada once very charitably said that the only difference between himself and his disciples is that he's always praying to Krishna, please don't allow me to fall. He said, but my disciples, they have no fear of Maya as their problem. No fear of Maya. Just wander around, yeah, you know, Hari Bol, yeah, we're in the material world, yeah, I mean, you know. It's Krishna, there's Maya, yeah. Don't be too strict. It's not good to be too strict. Bad for your psychology. You know what happens to the strict devotees. Those who surrendered for many years being strict. Makes them weak for Maya when you're strict. So, we have no fear of Maya. We have no understanding. Just like we could say, Nikendra's house. His wife had no fear. She was in the kitchen, it was 6:15 in the morning, broad, you know, morning sunlight. Yeah, leave the front door open. What's the problem, you know? What's the problem? I'm safe in my house. Everything is warm, and the hearth and home emotions, you know, in the kitchen, making prasad. So, left the front door open. Of course, who would have thought such a thing would happen? But the unthinkable sometimes happens. So, similarly, we have that attitude about the material world. Ah, yeah, here we are in Perth, especially in Perth. Yeah, never a worry in Perth. The dole money always flows. And if there's Oz study, there's TAFE, and you know, there's always something, you know. The living is easy, you know. No need to be fearful of anything. You amble by the temple from time to time, you know. You do a little seva even, but you know, just have things go on. Don't commit yourself too much. And don't let anyone try to commit you either. It's life in Perth. No fear of the material energy. But then you hear reports of devotees contracting diseases and you start to wonder, wait a minute, this is violating the tranquility. Yes, even in Perth, we must be fearful of sinful reactions. How do you show your fear of sinful reactions? Do you just, like, tremble in your tracks? Oh, sinful reaction. Oh, I'm afraid. Oh. No. You show your fear of sinful reactions by arranging your life, by managing your life, so that you're protected. And what is the best way to protect yourself? Keeping yourself engaged in devotional service and developing attachment for the holy name. So when you look at the world, what do you see? You just see the clouds in the sky and the traffic on the roads and the houses here and there. And people scurrying about, driving about, walking about. No, you have to see the network of sinful reactions manifest now and what will manifest in the future. Rupa Goswami, in his book, Dhirasamrita Sindhu, explains the four stages of sinful reaction. It starts in a dormant stage, then there's a little seed, and then it starts to manifest more, and then there's the full manifestation of the reaction. Just like when you get a cold, you know, the cold germs enter your body, and they maybe are dormant for a while, and then little effect starts to develop. Maybe you get a little sniffles or a little headache. And if you're smart, you catch it right there and you reach for your echinacea. But you may not do that And so then the cold symptoms get worse, and then boom, full on. An intelligent person's aware that it's just a matter of time before sinful reactions manifest. Therefore, what can I do to cleanse myself of my past sinful activities? When you think about the things that you did, that you can remember, that you know were sinful in this life, well, that's enough to make you shake. What to speak of all the things you don't know, all the things you don't remember, and what to speak of the previous lives' sinful reactions, which you're still responsible for. Living in this world is a very, very precarious thing. Living in this world is not a casual matter. You are responsible for what you did in your previous births, even though you cannot remember your previous births. You may know what is sinful activity, what is not. Now you may know that. But still, what did you do previously in this lifetime? That will be taken into account. Therefore, a smart person makes a program how to counteract sinful activity. And in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, the best program for countering sinful activity is not to perform pious activities, but to get off the material platform completely and surrender to me. Then I'll personally protect you. We should pay attention to what Mother Ganges is saying and her fears. She's not worried about her own sinful activity, but still she knows it's the material world. Sinful people will bathe in me. I'll be contaminated by association. How shall I become free from all these reactions deposited in me? So if Ganga Devi has this fear, what to speak of us? Any questions?
Sometimes people argue that is it fair that people have Jews who suffer reactions to things that they can't remember doing in their previous life? Doesn't appear to be very balanced.
You look in the mirror in the morning, and if you see a material body, that means sinful reaction. Otherwise, you shouldn't have a material body. The very presence of your material body lets you know you made a mistake. You're guilty. You're not innocent. If you look in the mirror and you see a material body, you should know you're not innocent. The problem is that people aren't equipped with this knowledge of how the spirit soul accepts a body and gives it up only to take another body. They don't know that material body means guilty. It's the prison uniform. Why don't they think it's the prison uniform? Because they're so attached to sex life, they think, oh, the body is the opportunity for pleasure. So, they require radical education. They require radical effort at education. They do not understand even the basics of human civilization. There are so many examples of you forgetting things that you did, but still you have to take the reaction. You might have forgot you charged something on your credit card, and then, ooh, and maybe you've had that experience. Oh, I bought that? My God. Yes, it's happened, Eric? Yes? Why everyone wants to blame Krishna when they don't blame, you know, anyone for these ordinary material things that happen all the time? But as soon as Krishna arranges something, the blame. How can you give us sinful reactions when we don't remember the sins? But if you get a credit card bill in the post, oh, I spent that. Okay. All right. I got to pay. Another example, when university students in New Zealand were telling me, you know, the students, they have their wild weekends, their hostel parties, you know, and they just get blasted with alcohol and then, you know, just cohabit with whoever's around, you know. Can't even remember. They're so blind, you know, so drunk that I guess that's the whole point, to get so drunk that you don't remember who you're with on the night. Is that the way it works? That's the object, I guess, you know, so, you know. And so I said, well, what happens, I like to ask these provocative questions, you know. What happens, you know, if, you know, a few days later, you know, you know, when the weekdays come and there's school classes and there you are walking on the campus and you kind of halfway recognize, ooh, this was the one I was with 2 days ago. I thought, what do people, what do the students do then? They know, they just kind of, you know, good day, you know, they keep walking, it's just, you know, it's just, they just adjust that. Well, you know, we were drunk that weekend and who knows what happened. And so, I thought, aren't they embarrassed? Like, you know, you're in the library looking for a book for your course, and then, you know, standing next to you is someone also looking on the shelf in the library at the university, and you look at their, it was you last night. I said, aren't they embarrassed? Does this happen sometimes? I said, yeah, it happens, but, you know, everyone just socially accepts that. You know, when you're wasted, you know, it's so drunk, you know, things happen, and it's not really, it's like two different worlds, you know. There's the sober world and the drunk world, and you know, both worlds are kept separate. So what you do when you're completely drunk is, you know, it's another reality. And, you know, what you do when you're sober, well, that you have to be responsible for. But when you're drunk, you know, anything can go on, you know. So that's why they get drunk. So they can enter into that imaginary world free from reactions. That's what it is. It's the Kali Yuga way of getting free from sinful reactions. I was drunk. You can't be held responsible for anyone, you're drunk. So every weekend, they get blasted. Every weekend. Well, students were telling me. So there's an example of a foolish way to try to avoid reactions. But still, sometimes they meet up with each other and they just, you were the one, they keep walking. Anything else?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes observations made that this whole sort of New Age philosophy and et cetera is a... is come about like the influence of like the Sankara movement. It's like a sort of a low stage of purification. And would you agree with that?
I like Palanananda Maharaj's characterization of the fivefold miseries: birth, death, old age, disease, and new age. It's an affliction. You've rarely seen those types take up Krishna consciousness, have you? In fact, you know, when you meet them on the street for book distribution, a new age type person, it's always, I'm spiritual. I really appreciate what you're doing. Yeah, no, I don't need your book because, you know, we're both already into it, you know. We're both, you know, spiritual. So, yeah, nice book, yeah. Yeah, yes, very, very good. Yeah, you're doing nice work. I'm glad we're both resonating with the, you know, the whatever. Very difficult to preach to such persons because they already think they're full. You're trying, they already think, yeah, I know what's spiritual, I'm already in touch. You go on out, continue distributing your books to those persons who need the knowledge. And also they have this kind of superiority complex that, well, you are spiritual, but of course you're tied to a particular dogma. And, you know, we're more advanced than we realize that spirituality just flows without boundaries and dogmas and books and teachers. And it's just out there. You just tap into it. You said things like that before? You would say things like that?
No.
Right. It's good that you're involved in the Hari's Krishna consciousness field. They're happy people. Of course, on a higher level, one goes beyond these orthodox traditions and just flows with the free spirit that moves everywhere. So, there's no doubt. At least I have no doubts the New Age is an affliction. It's just another rationalization to have illicit sex. That's all it came down to me. And you know, you all know, you do the body, mind, and spirit festivals. You cater for that. So you see how receptive they are. The only good thing is they like to buy prasad. Otherwise, you can't talk to them. Very rare can you, really can you talk to them. They're just in the cloud. Because of the, that's an after effect of the Sankirtan movement. You know, it's a beneficial outcome. That's like saying, before there was New Age in the 70s, I remember as a young devotee, when the Hare Krishna was starting to boom in the Western cities. At the same time, there were so many bogus yogis and avatars coming over from India. Prabhupada would just say, in New York, he'd say, every day now at Kennedy International Airport in New York, a new god is landing on the plane from on Air India. Every day a new god is flying in from India. It was like that, you know? This one, that one, this one, that one. This one's God. This one's an avatar. It was so oppressive for devotees. I remember doing book distribution in 1973. I would meet at least 10 persons a day who would tell me, you know, so-and-so, their yogi or swami they're following, he's God. At least 10 persons, all of their different gods they're following, swami so-and-so. You know, this Maharaj, that Maharaj, he's God, you know. That was the times back then. And there's a special one, this Bal Yogi, you know. Yeah. He was 16, supposedly 16 years old then. That was his advertised age. He was known as Guru Maharaji. He filled a sports stadium in New York City. 50,000 people came to see the boy God. Embarrassing. That's how heavy it was then. 50,000 people turned out to a sports stadium to see the boy God from India. It was only Prabhupada who would dare to challenge him. Prabhupada would tell the newspapers, you must decide whether he's God or a dog. And then when Guru Maharaji got a toothache, you know, it was printed in the newspaper, so Prabhupada's response was printed all over the world, that what's happening? God has a toothache. Oh, one time someone came up to him on a podium and threw a cream pie in his face. The Prabhupada again commented, what is this? What kind of God is this? Ultimately, the boy God had a fallout with his mother, who was managing him, and she announced to the world press, actually, I made a mistake. He's not God, it's my other son who's God. So people were buying into all this. Now, we wouldn't say that all that bogus, those bogus avatars and bogus incarnations, that whole wave was a product of the Sankirtan movement. No, we consider it hellish. Similarly, I don't consider all this foolish religiosity, pseudo-acceptance of reincarnation and all these other things to be Lord Chaitanya's mercy in any way, or in any way related to anything positive. Because we can see those people are the hardest to talk to. I accept reincarnation, of course. They have no idea of the actual implications of transmigration of the soul. Yeah, I'll be a human being again, and we'll just move towards perfection, birth after birth. Yes. Whatever learning experiences I get in this life will lead to a better next life. I'll just learn and be in touch with everything, be in contact with everything, and evolve.
Could New Age movement be compared to
our
Sampradayas in after Lord Chaitanya? Is there some comparison?
There's always darkness and light side by side. So my opinion is, and it seems quite obvious, the New Age is a nuisance. It hasn't done anything. In fact, it's really affected even our devotees. Our devotees unconsciously, many of them have unconsciously taken on New Age notions. Well, you know, it's just up to you how you kind of conceive of Krishna consciousness and follow it, you know, and it's not good to kind of, you know, accept any kind of spiritual authority. I mean, that's not really healthy. And also it's not very good to be strict so much, because that's injurious, you know. I mean, you have to have a healthy mixture in your life of Krishna and Maya, because I mean Maya does have its good purposes. I mean, you know, you can learn a lot by being in Maya, you know. It's I had one devotee here in Perth telling me, well, you know, it's best to live together before you're married, to see if you can live together. I said, wait a minute, that's not even accepted by traditional Christian morality, you know, meat eater morality of the Christian church doesn't even accept that. Now, how can you say from any kind of Vedic viewpoint that such a thing is accepted? Well, you know, I mean, yeah, well, you know, you just got to do what you got to do, you know, and, you know, if it works, it's okay, you know, and there's the effect of the New Age. It's basically what you feel, how you feel about things. That's the ultimate judge. There's no precise dharma. There's no strict dharma. It's just what your heart feels and what you can see is good for you. So, unconsciously, many devotees are affected by that. I mean, after all, I do still believe in reincarnation. You know, I believe in these things, so that's what the New Agers say. Yeah, we believe in reincarnation, of course. Vegetarianism also. You know, it's the organic sense gratification. So, yes, New Age has definitely affected weaker devotees in Krishna conscious society. They don't know it, though. But they've taken aboard a lot of the notions. Just kind of be spiritual in your own way, and, of course, don't eat meat, and, you know, wear cotton clothes, and, you know. Chant when you can. Yeah, chant when you can. That's more beneficial. If you chant because you have to, the bhakti isn't there. But if you chant when you feel like it, Krishna really appreciates that. But chanting just because you have to, no, that's not good. You can go to the temple when you feel like it, engage in service when you feel like it, you know, and then it's really blissful and productive. There shouldn't be any ashrams. Oh, ashrams are that old way. No, everything just has to be wide open. So you can serve Krishna when you feel like it. No one should tell anyone what to do. So this is what's going on. So, no, I don't see that New Age is in any way symptomatic of anything beneficial or anything positive for Lord Chaitanya's movement. A little knowledge is sometimes worse than none. It's like, it's the equivalent of India, where, you know, you may preach in India and people say, well, I already know about Krishna. Yeah, we know all about Krishna. There's this familiarity. So now that familiarity, in another way, has come to the West. Yeah, we know about reincarnation. Maybe you remember when you were a new devotee and you would preach to someone about transformation of the soul. It's like, wow. It's not like that now. Yeah, of course, yeah, you know. Yeah. So what if I'm a bird in my next life? It'll be fun to fly around. Yeah, they say like that. I remember I was in Melbourne last year. There were about 20 people come for a program. And so I just, you know, figured I'd have a bit of fun, you know. I said, you know, we were talking about meditation and consciousness. I just said, well, you know, someone was saying, I do meditation. I said, well, what kind of meditation? Because everybody's meditating on something. It's nothing unusual to meditate. The question is, what are you meditating on? you know, letting out the breath and the ingoing, the outgoing breath. So I just decided to have some fun. I said, tell me, how many of you here have tried pig meditation? 18 out of 20, raise your hand. Yeah, they had actually thought about what it's like to be a pig. 18 out of 20, without any hesitation. Yeah, I thought about, you know, pig's life, what it'd be like to be a pig, you know? I thought it was cool, you know? Just laying in the mud, eating whatever you want, having sex with anything around you. Yeah, they were in a shape. Pig meditation. Yeah, I don't know. 18 out of 20. I was shocked, you know. I was like, oh my gosh. I didn't let them see that, of course. This was going on these days. The whole point was that we were discussing how your consciousness now determines your next birth. So, you know, they were saying, yeah, we considered pig meditation. In other words, we don't mind being pigs. If there's some fun in it, if there's some, you know, grunting and, sense gratification, yeah, why not? They couldn't conceive of anything higher. Pigs, yeah, they must be having a good time somehow. So, this is how things are these days. My conclusion is we have to preach the message of Bhagavatam very strongly and with compassion. As always, that's the only solution. Cultivate your spiritual intelligence. Learn a different way of looking at the world. Don't look at the world and see possibilities for pleasure. Look at the world and see how it's dangerous, how it's alluring. Get a different vision of the world. That's like living in Bayswater and thinking, oh, it's so quiet here, there's no need to worry about thieves. Yeah, now you know you need a different vision. Somebody will walk in your house in broad daylight. The police said you could be in the back of your, you know, in the back of your house in your garden. They'll see you there and they'll come right in into the house, knowing you're in the garden. That's how bold they are. So now, because of these events, I'm sure devotees have a different vision of their area now. I hope so. You know, it cost me a bit for you to get that vision. So, similarly, you have to have a different vision of this world. Like, oh, here we are in Perth. Everything is just so nice, you know. Comfortable. Never too many upsets. And every once in a while, there's a bit of a hubbub at the temple, you know. But anyway, just life goes on. You get that feeling in Perth, right? Life goes on. Yeah. You know. Yes, it's like that, right? Kind of like you get this lost in time feeling. So now you have to see things differently. You develop that intelligence by studying the Shastra, listening to transcendental knowledge. Change your perceptions. Okay, yes, you have a question?
How do you basically explain to people who don't accept any authority of God or scriptures about the danger that is involved, particularly in bringing up children and letting them, you know, take part in activities you know that are able to be sinful, and it's known that if consequences are dealt with now, then they'll just take the one to be sinful, and there's no authority of scriptures.
If you're expert, you can explain to them from the material point of view how it's injurious, and also from the spiritual point of view. I generally do that approach. I say, even from the material point of view, this doesn't make sense. Like there was one 16-year-old girl, and she was telling me how, you know, she brings her boyfriend home, spends the weekend, he spends the weekend in her room, you know. The mother mother gets up in the morning and there's the boyfriend in the kitchen with a towel wrapped around him, you know, getting together some cornflakes and this and that, and the mother just says, oh, hello. You know? So it's all considered like that. But I said, you've got a 14-year-old sister. What do you think she's thinking watching this? Ooh, I never thought of that. What do you think your 14-year-old sister is doing and thinking watching you, the 16-year-old sister, you know, entertaining a guy at your house, you know, for the weekend?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Of course, 14-year-old's thinking, when's mine? When is my time come? And I said, what does your mother say about this? Mother just says, as long as you're happy. Yeah. And they all say, all the parents say, better you do it at home than be forced to, you know, copulate in a city park or something. Better it's in our warm home. Because the parents are ignorant, they're having children who are even more ignorant. And what's the next generation going to be like? Yeah, right. What is the future of this country? Really? What are the things that hold the country together? There's some kind of culture, some moral values. It's going to have to turn into a police state. Because there's no understanding of even common decency. I was speaking about this in Melbourne in class. And then one congregational member in class, he raised his hand in Australian. No, my parents are different. Let me tell you. You know, my sister, she's 22. My parents say that if he's going to spend the night with her, he can't stay in her room. They make a bed in the living room and they can stay there, but not in her room. He was serious. No, they refuse. My parents are strict. They refuse to allow him to spend the night in her room. No, they you know, they just put out a little, what do you call those, settee, you know, something like that. They put out a settee in the living room and they have to stay there. There's rules in my house. He was sitting there with a straight face. This is how things are these days. So those are the strict parents. Unbelievable, isn't it? Therefore I say, what is the future of this society? You judge the future of a society by the quality of the citizens. Now, what will the next generation be like? What will the, other than the Kalindis, what will the 11 and 12-year-olds be like in 10 years? Yeah. In 20 years? They'll be the future of the country. They'll be wild. There's no honor and dedication to anything except make as much money as you can by spending as little effort as possible. That's it. Everything else is up for grabs. Basically, you're going to have a slave society controlled by police. That's the only way the country would stay together. Therefore, we have a lot of preaching to do, a lot of distribution of books, because some people will want to know better. And it's our duty to give them the knowledge they need to reform themselves and reform society. All right. Hare Krishna. Of course. You can load it up. It's a little thing. You can load it up with like 3 gigabytes worth of hearing and chanting. So that's what saves me on plane trips. I can just listen to Prabhupada, you know, listen to someone reading teachings of Lord Chaitanya or Nectar Devotion, like that. I took my cell phone, my 3-band cell phone. It can handle any frequency in the world. I took my digital camera. Taking devotional shots of temples and devotees. So I made quite a heist. And of course they took some cash and took all my cash and all my documents and all my plastic. So I just thought, well, that's the end of that. You know, what can be done? You know, who would have expected such a thing to happen? I couldn't blame Seva Kunj, I mean, you know. Who would have thought, you know? I mean, just the house, the door of the house is behind trees. You know, you have to really, you know. Of course, when you're a thief, You're looking for opportunity. Just like if you're a lusty person, you oh, yes, this is a good one for me. So it's just a different vision that we don't have. We have the vision to be alert for Krishna's service. A devotee is always alert for more opportunities to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When a devotee loses that vision, then you know you've slipped. When the devotee's vision starts to become dull, maybe like a batsman in cricket who no longer can see the ball, you know, then you're of no value. Your vision starts to get off of it. So, a devotee always has a keen eye. Where is there a service opportunity? What more can I do for Krishna? That is evidence that the devotee is on the right track for stimulating his original love for Krishna. So these crims, who could have thought, you know, who would have thought, you know? You never thought such a thing, would you, Ronnie? I mean, you know they're break-ins here, but, you know, something so brazen, like 6:15 in the morning, daylight, you know, with somebody in the house, you know? But the police said, sometimes they'll look and see if you're in the back of your house doing gardening, and they'll just come right in the front door. So I guess it's not really a classified as a burglary, it's like a home invasion, isn't it? Yeah. So, we don't have such things in the States because, you know, everybody carries a gun in the States. There's no such, that word home invasion doesn't exist in American vocabulary because you break in someone's home, you know, while they're there. And according to law, they have the right to blow you away. And, you know, there'll be no charges filed. You are trespassing. There was a case, famous case a few years ago of a Japanese tourist in some rural town in Louisiana, southern part of the USA, and he was evidently trying to get directions or something, and he went up to someone's door and, you know, the person, you know, shot them dead. The person generally explained, I thought this was a marauder. I didn't know who this was. I thought this was an attacker. And no charges were filed. So there's no such thing as home invasion in the USA, you know, because no crim would dare, you know. You know, the burglaries, that's when no one's there. But, when, you know, to walk into a homeowner's place while somebody's there, it's like the criminal's inviting death. You just don't know what, you know, whether the homeowner is packing a pistol or a semi-automatic or a machine gun. You just don't know anything possible. It's all legal, you know. So anyway, I was thinking, oh, well, that's, yeah, what can I do? You know, it's just obviously in it. And an attack by Maya, and you know, it's life in this world is going to incur some damage. But I said, oh, well, all my hearing and chanting is gone. That was what I lamented the most. More than losing a bundle of cash and all the documents. I said, oh, how can I live without my hearing and chanting? And then, meanwhile, in the midst of all this, because I had been peacefully chanting japa in the temple room. When, you know, the news came. So then I immediately had to go over there to the house. And I put my beads down. And amidst all the hubbub, I couldn't remember where I put my beads. So that became the paramount anxiety. Not even more than losing all those things. Like, where are my beads? I can't chant Hare Krishna. Yeah. So it was amazing how... You know, devotees have different perspectives on loss. I was lamenting, oh, my hearing and chanting facilities are gone. Now I can't find my japa beads. Then I found my other passport, my New Zealand passport with my Indian visa. They left that. Oh, somebody, I can go to the Holy Dom. So devotees just look at the world differently. Of course, I was very angry they had taken Krishna's Lakshmi. All the Lakshmi the temples give for my airfare. They just clipped all that. What could I do? You know, I never expected such a brazen attack. So then I was laying on the, I was sitting on the couch, and, you know, it was about 2 hours later, and And of course, the police had come. We gave them a police report, and the police, of course, said, good luck if you ever see this again. Just forget about it. And the phone rings. It's the police. We have your stuff. We've apprehended the crims. What? I couldn't believe it. So we had to get in the car and drive over to, where is it?
Near.
Yeah. And, you know, the police very proudly escorted us into their private area, you know, and there was the stuff all laid out on the floor. And we said, well, how did you do it? You know, wanted to, you know, inspire them and, you know, give them a chance to recount their glories. We were driving along the road and we just, you see, we had given them a report. Dritti had seen the car, the getaway car. So she had given them a report. You know, it was a black Civic Honda with a spoiler. I was a bit impressed. I never knew that women knew what a spoiler was. That's the first thing I thought when I heard her say it. Oh, maybe a woman knows what a spoiler is. So, anyway, it wasn't even that car that they were in that the police apprehended. It was a total, the police said it was a fluke. We know it was Krishna's arrangement. You know, policeman was, the police car was driving in that area and noticed a car a bit weaving, you know, not keeping a straight line. And of course, you know, being Western Australia, the police looked in the car as it was weaving and saw that, you know, well, there's certain kind of people in that car. Definitely pull them over. Yeah. So, the police followed them, you know, motioned them to get over, and the car wouldn't get over. So the police said, now we were really suspicious, the car won't pull over. But at the same time, the car wouldn't pull away. So, you know, and into a mad pursuit. That didn't force the police into a mad pursuit. Oh, and finally the car pulls over and all the occupants jump out and start running. And immediately the police said, oh, they're stolen goods in that car. That's why they're taking off. So he corralled most of them. You know, and so then they, yeah, confiscated all the contents of the car. And, you know, they had heard the police report about the break-in, so they knew. They put one and one together, and so they called me over and said, we've got your stuff. Come identify it, you know. And so while I was identifying the stuff, you know, they kept asking me, well, this is really flash, isn't it? This is really expensive. Because they wanted, you know, high prices so they could make the charges really big. I don't know what the law is in Australia. In the States, like, petty theft is no big deal, but if it goes over a certain amount, then they can really slam you. Is that what it is here, too? No. Anyway, they go, how much is the value? It's higher, higher. I really want to get these guys. They all come, are you sure? This looks really flash to me. Or maybe it impresses the judge or something if they bring up that, you know, this is like not any little nickel and this is not any little, you know, 10-cent escapade. This is a, you know, big theft. Is that what they do? Yeah, so they, you know, you sure? Looks more expensive than that to me. So anyway, by the time we finished, we had calculated about $8,000, $8,000 Australian. They were satisfied with that. And so then as I was leaving, you know, I thanked the policeman very much. He was the young guy. He was really beaming, like, yeah, you know, you've done, you know, this will look great in my record. I guess that's what he's thinking of, you know, this will really look good in my file. So I, you know, I thanked him. I said, you know, I can appreciate good law enforcement work, you know. I said, most of my relatives in the state, you know, work, you know, they're ranking officers in the New York City Police Department. And so they, you know, kind of looked at me. It's all right, you know, the Aussies will take care of you. So, you know, that is life in this world, that there's always gain and loss, but we have to make sure that we're centered upon Krishna. Otherwise, we'd lose our sanity in this world. It's constant loss, constant gain, and Actually, during the whole affair, I was thinking of our devotee, Mother Suchirani, and how sudden loss, according to theft, is also like sudden attack on your health. These things just come out of nowhere. And that's part of living in this world. Mm-hmm. Your possessions can go in a second. Your health can go in a second. Mm-hmm. That's why whenever people tell me, how is your health? I say, it's all right for the moment. Because, the end is obvious. Health will diminish. You will lose your health. Mm. So I was thinking about Mother Suchirani all the time. What is this situation compared to, what she's going through? So, I was talking to Burijan Prabhu later, and he was explaining how the Buddhists, they say that loss of possessions is like a small death. For those who identify with their possessions, and for those who identify with their body, losing possessions, is a little bit like losing your body. We both, ammameti, I am this body, whatever is in relation to this body is mine. So, losing possessions is like a small death, because the body is also a possession. So, when you lose possessions or when they're stolen, you get some idea of what it's like, how attached you're going to feel when you lose your body, when your body is demanded of you. Mm. in the sixth canto, the story of the demigods asking the sage Dadichi for his body in order to make a thunderbolt weapon to kill Vritrasura. So, just to test them, Dadichi, didn't agree. The demigods were instructed, go see Dadichi, ask for his body. And so they did, but Dadichi just wanted to stimulate, he wanted to cause to happen a dialogue about Dharma. So when they asked him for his body, he said, how can you ask someone for their body? There's nothing more dear to the person than the body. Don't you know that? Don't you know about the pain of death? Death means when your body is separated from the soul. How could you put somebody through that? I can't give you my body. He said that just to test them. But actually, Nidichi was such an extraordinary sage. Oh, you want my body? Basically, his attitude was take it. Because those who refuse to sacrifice their body for the welfare of others, that are very miserable. They're very hard creatures. Those who refuse to use their body for the welfare of others are very horrible entities. Mm. So in this way, Dadichi gave them his body, and the demigods made a thunderbolt out of it to kill Vritrasura. Mm. So this situation caused me to reflect. The situation yesterday caused me to reflect upon the complications of living in this world. Mm. Shuman, he had to deal with complications, something his brothers did. And Shuman was trying to rectify the situation, so he's offering prayers to Lord Kapila. Please, can you let my brothers come back to life? And Kapila Muni said, the only way that can happen is if Ganges water, the river Ganges is brought here, that'll take care of them. Then they'll come back to life. Mm. So Amshuman tried. He could not succeed in his lifetime to bring the river Ganges to that area. And then his son, Dilipa, tried. And in his lifetime, he could not achieve the goal. Finally, you're at the point of Bhagiratha, King Bhagiratha. He performed severe austerities, and he succeeded in bringing the Ganges. Mm. Ganga Devi appeared before him, and that's what you're hearing today. I'm very much satisfied with your austerities, and am now prepared to give you benedictions as you desire. Mm. We should understand that our life is built on a foundation of yajna, jnana, tapa. This is explained by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, 18th chapter. Yajna, dana, tapa, karma, nachajam, karyam eva tat. The Lord explains that acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance are never to be given up. Krishna explains it. These things purify even the great souls. We have to look in our life and check these indexes. It's like in the newspapers, they have the financial indexes, you know, the charts and statistics from the stock share market and economic indicators. So what are the indicators in our life that we should check? Yajna, dana, tapa. How much sacrifice is there in our life? Yajna. How much dana, how much charity are we giving? And tapa, how much austerity is there? Then we can get some idea whether we're on the right track or not. In Kali Yuga, the only yajna that works is the Sankirtan yajna. Therefore, we have to look in our life and see how much Sankirtan is there. Congregational glorification of the Lord. Then, look for the dana, charity. We were speaking last night about how, especially for householders, giving charity is very important. Householders who do not give charity are in a very condemned situation. You can give charity not simply money, in the form of money, but you can also give in terms of time. Because as they say in the Western world, time is money. But there has to be some kind of charity in your life. And then tapa, austerity, voluntarily accepting inconvenience for a higher purpose. That has to be there in your life too. People will voluntarily accept inconvenience. They'll go to school or TAFE, for example, in order to get better situated in the future. But why don't we voluntarily accept some inconvenience for the sake of stimulating our original love for Krishna? Please remember this. Yajna, dana, tapa, karma, nachajam, karyam, evata. Acts of sacrifice, charity, and penance are never to be given up. These acts purify even a great soul. So you see, Krishna consciousness is not sentimental. It has some very necessary ingredients. It's like our chef Kurma knows that certain cooking thing ingredients are essential. You just can't do without them. Other things, they're optional. But he knows when he cooks, there has to be certain basics there, otherwise forget it. There may be some exotic spices available, that's nice, but if not, okay, as long as certain basics are there. So Krishna is saying in Bhagavad Gita, these things have to be there in your life, even if you're a great soul. These things purify even the great souls. Yajna, dana, tapa. Sacrifice, charity, and austerity. Now, Ganga Devi is satisfied by King Bhagiratha, and therefore, she's saying, ask whatever benediction you want. And so the king bows his head respectfully and is going to explain his desire that he wanted to deliver his forefathers who had been burnt to ashes because of disrespecting Kapila Muni. They were standing right before the Supreme Personality of God and they couldn't recognize him. They thought he was a horse thief. They're standing before Kapila Muni, the expounder of Sankhya, and they thought he was a horse thief. This is how crazy life in this world gets. This is how deluded someone can become. And Krishna doesn't hide this. He doesn't cover up that this tendency happens in the world. He explains it. Tribhya Gunamayir Bhavaya. What's the next line? A.B. Sarvam Idam Jagat. Krishna says, the whole world is bewildered by Trigunamayi, the three modes of material nature, so they don't recognize me. It's like if you wrote a book and explained how people misunderstand you. How they don't really know who you are. No one likes to be misunderstood. No one likes to be miscast, misperceived. So Krishna, he's the supreme person. He doesn't like it. So in Bhagavad Gita, he says, they're looking at me in the wrong way. They don't understand me. They think that first it was the impersonal, then there's me, the person. They have all these crazy ideas. Anyway, Bhagiratha is very merciful upon his forefathers. He wants to deliver them. And so he's successfully propitiated Ganga Devi, and now she's asking, please explain. Please tell me your desire. Huh? Any questions? Yes.
I was just thinking, it must have been thousands of years, between the time 60,000 sons were burned and liberated, so like two generations. So in the previous ages, obviously that was longer than lifetimes now.
Those living entities, the spirit souls of those 60,000 sons, what situation were they in? There's no mention of that. We can only speculate. Who can say? You do hear information about another son of Sagara Maharaj named, I forgot his name, but anyway, in his previous life, the Bhagavatam says, this son was a great mystic yogi, but due to bad association, he fell down. So therefore, he took birth in a royal family as a son of the king. And he was a jati smara. He could remember his past life. So he was very determined to stay out of any kind of material entanglement this time, just as Judd Bharat was. So he just acted like an avadut, irrespective of all social conventions. Even he's playing with his playmates, and he would take his mates and drown them in a pond. Just so people would not think he's a normal person, they'd leave him alone. And of course, naturally, the people were very upset that their sons were, you know, had been drowned, you know, by their playmate. So his father, in that way, gave up all attachment for him. I mean, if you had a son who drowned his playmates in the pond, you'd probably give up attachment for the son. So that was, you know, this is all the plot of the son. I don't want my father attached to me. I don't want anybody attached to me. I just want to wander free. I can focus on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So his father said, okay, you got to leave. So before the son left, with his mystic power, he brought all the dead playmates back to life. So all the people were like, wow, what kind of son is this? But he was gone. Well, that much we do know about the past life of that son. But there's so much in Bhagavatam. We can wonder about so many things, but we have enough information given to keep us occupied for all our life. Anything else? Yes?
Sometimes you can perform an emotional service, but when you're feeling blissful, you're not necessarily in the emotion. So, is that a unified state or something?
How are you blissful and not think of Krishna? How's that possible? If you're doing service, you must be thinking of Krishna. You see, thinking of how to do the service nicely is also thinking of Krishna. Thinking of the details of execution, that's also thinking of Krishna. If you chanted nice japa in the morning, it's very easy to remember who you're doing the service for during the day. So when you pay attention to the details of your service, how to do it nicely, you're meditating on Krishna. That's why in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, when the verse is there, always think of Krishna, never forget Krishna. This is the essence, conclusion of all Vedic knowledge. In the purport, Prabhupada talks about book distribution. He says, when you're selling Krishna's books, then naturally you're thinking, you know, about Krishna. How this person can get Krishna's glories. So therefore, he also said, book distribution, it's samadhi. That service so effectively fixes your mind at Krishna's lotus feet. Alright? Hare Krishna, all glories to the Prabhupada.